Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Journalist and author Tom Brokaw anchored the NBC Nightly News for 22 years. He's been working in the news for over 50 years, and he's published 10 books. Tom's best-known book is his first one from 1998, The Greatest Generation, about those who fought in World War II and helped out on the home front. His most recent book, which came out in 2019, is The Fall of Richard Nixon, A Reporter Remembers Watergate. Tom visited Traverse City in 2010 and talked with me on the stage of the City Opera House. I asked Tom to tell me how he came to write The Greatest Generation.
I was born in 1940, so my first memories of life are of World War II. We were living on an army base. And my first conscious memory is about people going to war, guy next door, young guy who was in high school, and he would play with me and entertain me, and then he was in uniform and he was going to war. Just across the street were two Sioux Americans, native Sioux, who were heavily decorated in the European theater, and they came home on leave. And as they deserved to, they got roaring drunk for a couple of days. And everybody up and down the street just said, leave them alone, they're going back. And there were trucks being driven by women. I can still see to this day a woman getting out of a big 8x10 truck with a bandana, wearing a pair of overalls and carrying a lunchbox. And that was my first impression about women being able to do things other than what they were expected to do in those days, which was to stay at home and clean and do the cooking. We were at an ordnance depot, so they were exploding ordnance, ammunition, and bombs out in the southwestern South Dakota prairie every day. It was like having your own homegrown fireworks show. And I thought the war would go on forever because that's all I had ever known. I wore a helmet to class, and I ran up and down the ditches and fought the Japanese and the Germans, the imaginary enemies coming over the prairie, and then suddenly it was over. And I moved to the central part of South Dakota in a very remote area on the edge of an Indian reservation, where my father went to work for the Corps of Engineers, and they were building big flood control dams and hydroelectric dams in those days in the middle of nowhere. And because of the can-do spirit of World War II and what they learned to do in short notice, they would build a town seemingly overnight. They would literally build a town within 2 years, a whole town. It looked like an army base. It'd have paved streets and curb and gutter and movie theater and a hospital and a hotel and a very good high school and a shopping center and then a lot of government housing. And we had the best house we'd ever had. It was one half of a duplex with three bedrooms, one bathroom. And my parents just couldn't believe their good fortune. My dad was making a pretty good wage. And we had all these opportunities surrounding us because we were in the boom time of the 1950s. And from all over America, workers came. And they were able to buy their first new car and buy something called a deep freeze and to have running water and to have indoor toilets. Many of them had never had that before, and they were making good wages, and they were able to buy their children real Christmas presents and not have hand-me-downs. So there was this almost palpable sense of optimism and of celebration of the goodness of American life, and we began to take it for granted. And, you know, I caught the good wave and married a wonderful woman. 1962, we went off to Omaha, to Atlanta, to Los Angeles, and before too long, I was making five times as much as my father had ever made. I was able to travel the world, and I ended up in Washington, and then I'm the White House correspondent, going to the White House State Dinners. Now I'm in New York, and first I did the Today Show, and then I was the anchor of Nightly News. And in 1984, we decided that we should do the 40th anniversary of D-Day, Normandy. And I was a pretty keen student of American military history, so I said, absolutely, let's do that. And I was also thinking, with the other side of my brain, man, this is going to be great. I'm going to be in Normandy for a week, eating great French food, drinking good wines and calvados, and running through the countryside. And I went, and we had lined up a representative group of veterans, two guys from the Big Red One, the first division, a couple of guys from the 82nd Airborne, a military chaplain, and one of the Rangers from the 2nd Battalion, one of the boys at Punta Hawk that took the cliffs. And we met them for dinner the night before, and they just seemed like everybody who'd ever raised me. I mean, I was just so familiar with all of them. They looked like the guys that I knew at the American Legion Club or at the Vets Club, and I thought, boy, this is going to be a piece of cake. And I walked down the beach the next morning, Omaha Beach, with the two guys from the 1st Division, one of them who later earned the Medal of Honor, and the other one who later lost his legs in the Battle of the Bulge. And as we stepped onto the beach, I looked over and saw their wives. They were clutching their handbags. They had kind of plastic headdresses pulled down tight like everybody I'd ever known growing up. They'd got new permanents the night before. And the men were wearing their American Legion windbreakers. And I said, tell me what happened. And they stopped and they lowered their voices. And they began to describe the horror, June 6, 1944. They were 19 years old. And when the ramp went down on their Higgins boat in the first wave, their lieutenant and their first sergeant were shot dead before they hit the water. Now these guys were on their own. They rushed ashore as best they could, threw themselves down on the sand in a state of stark terror, and couldn't move. And one of them, Gino Murley, said, but there was a 34-year-old colonel who came loping down the beach like in a morning jog and said, come on, boys, we've got to move forward. We can't win the war here. We've got to keep going. And he said, that gave us enough courage to go to that bluff. And one turned to the other and said, do you remember what was going on there? And he said, I'll never forget it. And I said, what was that? And they said, well, that bluff had been laced with landmines, and a sapper unit had gone advance to detonate them and to mark the trails. But given the chaos of the moment, many of them had stepped on the landmines, shattered their legs or their arms. They just simply rolled off to the side, shot themselves up with morphine, took a cigarette break, and instructed us to come on and told us, walk there, don't walk there, walk there, don't walk there. And when we got to that top of the bluff, about noon, we thought we'd live this day. And we knew that from then on in our lives, we would live it one day at a time. And they fought every day for the next year. Well, by then, in the first 90 minutes of filming, my life had been changed. And I realized how much we owed those two men and the millions of others who had shown such great courage in European theater, North Africa, the beaches of the Pacific, the skies, on the seas and beneath them. And I went back a kind of shaken person, and then I heard Bud Lamel's story, one of the boys at Punta Hawk. Then I heard from the 82nd Airborne, and by the end of the week, I went home and said to my wife, my God, we have no appreciation of all that our parents went through and their friends went through. And I began to collect the stories, not quite knowing what I was going to do with them. I began calling the parents of high school friends and coaches and men that I'd known growing up, remembering that they'd been in the war, and had them tell me their stories. And I began to use them in commencement addresses, keeping notes. By the 50th anniversary, 10 years later, that was a memorable time when Ronald Reagan stood on the cliff and talked about the boys at Punta Hawk, and at that point he was talking about my friend Bud Lamel. I was going on the Today Show, and I thought a little bit about what I wanted to say, and I said out loud to Katie Couric, you know, this generation, in their formative years, went through the Great Depression, when life was all about sacrifice, common cause, and deprivation, and going without. And then, just as they got into their late teens or early 20s, they were asked to go to the far reaches of the Pacific and into the bitter cold of Europe, into the burning sands of North Africa, and fight these two monstrous military machines. And we were not really prepared to get into that war. 1940, the United States was the 16th military power in the world. We had more horses than we had troops. And then I said, you know, Katie, they came home and they could have put down their weapons and gone back to their hometowns and said, I've done my share. But they didn't. They went to college in record numbers. They got married in record numbers. They built new industries and gave us new science and new art. And they never stopped giving back. I believe, I said, it's the greatest generation any society has ever produced. And when I finished, I thought, God, I wonder if I've gone too far. And I was unhooking my microphone, and Stephen Ambrose was pounding me on the back, saying, if you don't write that, I will. The greatest generation. That's the phrase. And I said, well, I've been thinking about it. So I proceeded to collect more stories and put it in book form. And my publisher had some reservations about the title, The Greatest Generation. God, are you going too far? Can we market that? Is that something that's defensible? And in a meeting with the publisher at the time, I came up with a phrase that I've continued to use. I looked at her and I said, that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Had Ambrose published Band of Brothers yet?
Band of Brothers came out about the same time. Band of Brothers came out a little bit after. This all came out in 1998. I was finishing this book. Unknown to me, Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks were making Saving Private Ryan. So in August, Steven called me and said, I'd known him. He said, I'd like you to go to a screening of a new film. And I went, and it began, and I looked at Meredith and I said, oh my God. There's simultaneity here that no one could have anticipated. But Band of Brothers came out a little bit after that, as I remember. And no one knew what to expect. I wrote it in about a year and a half because I was working on something else, and this book was just continuing to press me. And I went to the publisher and said, I want to change. And I outlined what I wanted to write, The Greatest Generation. And they said, stop everything and go write that. It came out in time for Christmas of 1998. I had never written a book before. I didn't know what to expect. And there had been a lot of chaos along the way. My editor's husband had died midway through the book, and so I've lost her. I was finding my way through this new process. But a couple of friends of mine who had written books stepped in, read the galleys, came back to me and said, there are a couple of things that you need to clean up here, but by the way, it's going to be a bestseller. I said, how do you know? They said, just trust me. So it hit the bookstores in December, and as Doug knows, that's a terrifying moment for an author. You know, you've poured your life into something. Are people going to respond? And I was telling Doug earlier today that it was selling at the rate of one every 90 seconds for a long time, and it stayed on the bestseller list at number one from December of that year well into the spring, more than 6 months. This is not as immodest as it sounds, because my most heartfelt belief about my role in this book is that I was a doorman. I opened a door and said, there are stories here that we all need to hear, and America was ready to hear them. And the veterans, for the first time, were ready to talk about them.
Did it change your reporting pre-Greatest Generation, post-Generation? I mean, did you start asking different questions about Americans you met in general, having gone through that transformative experience on the beach?
No, I don't think so. I think I was a true reflection of their values personally and saw my life through that prism. I do remember during the 60s, the great conflict in The Greatest Generation, which I later came to The Greatest Generation. One of the stories that I tell about the 60s is, imagine if you're a Marine who's gone through World War II. You dropped out of school in Detroit at the age of 17 and joined the Marine Corps. And then you went to Iwo Jima, and you went to Peleliu, and you went to Okinawa, and you came home. And you married the girl down the street, and you went to work for the Ford Motor Company on the line. And you caught the good wave. You got the good benefits, the good wages, mm-hmm. You got the good pension program. And by the mid-1950s, you bought a house. That was unheard of in your family. And you had two children, a boy and a girl. And they had more things than you ever could have imagined mm-hmm. as a youngster. And before too long, you bought a little fishing cabin in the Upper Peninsula somewhere, and you got a boat to go with it, and you'd spend your weekends coming up here. And then one day in 1967, you come home for supper, as we called it, and it's 5:30, and it's time to watch Walter Cronkite or Chet Huntley and David Brinkley. You still have a crew cut. Put your lunchbox down in the kitchen, sit down at the kitchen table, and you look up, and your daughter is sitting there with hair on her legs, because it's not, it's, if you want to be liberated, you don't have to shave your legs anymore. She's not wearing a brassiere or any other undergarments. And she's got a boyfriend who's wearing his sunglasses inside and seems not to have shampooed or cut his hair in the last 4 years. And his name is Zeke. And he plays in a heavy metal band. And she said, "Daddy, Zeke and I are going to move in together, but don't worry about it, I'm on the pill." Now he looks to his son, who's sitting across the table, for some help. And his son is sitting there with an American flag with a swastika over it, with America spelled with a K. And he said, "Dad, I'm not going to fight no war in Vietnam. I'm headed for Canada. I'm going to burn my draft card." This old Marine turns around to his wife, looking for some kind of assistance. She's got her hands on her hips behind him, and she says, "Hey, big guy, how come I'm the only one who does the dishes around here?" That's pretty much a portrait of what was going on in a lot of households in America. Now, having said that, they all got through it together somehow.
Right.
They were able to find their way back together as families, and they all learned from one another. And that's part of the resilient strength of this country, I believe.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Tom Brokaw talks about reporting on the Watergate scandal.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to my conversation with Tom Brokaw.
1968, that's a cataclysmic year in your book, Boom. Have we had our 1968 in the 21st century? I mean, are we headed for it?
We've not had a 1968 because the wheels completely came off the system. People, in a lot of ways, have, I suppose, modified their memories of that time. A lot of people on the left have said that was the most glorious year of my life. A lot of people on the right have said it was the worst year in the history of the country. It was mostly a time of enormous turbulence in which all that we believed in was tested. It began with Lyndon Johnson saying, "We're turning the corner in Vietnam and the American economy is strong." Within a month, he'd been successfully challenged by Gene McCarthy in New Hampshire, and he was forced to go on national television and announce he would not be a candidate for re-election, for renomination. This proud Texan, who had won in a landslide just 4 years earlier, after he had succeeded John Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy gets into the race. Dr. King, who had led nothing less than a moral crusade in the South and had gotten the Civil Rights Act passed, had now turned himself to economic opportunity. He was trying to hold off very radical and violent elements within the Civil Rights Movement. Goes to Memphis to stand with the striking sanitation workers. He is murdered in cold blood on a motel balcony. And America goes up in the inner cities, in Detroit, Washington, D.C. almost burned down, in Los Angeles, all across the North, all across this country, the inner city went up, with the exception of Indianapolis, where Bobby Kennedy had arrived that night, made the announcement, and talked passionately but coolly about how violence is not the answer, and kept that city intact. And then Bobby Kennedy wins the California primary the first Tuesday in June, thanks to supporters, flashes the peace sign and says, on to Chicago, steps into a hotel kitchen corridor, and he's shot at point-blank range by a deranged young Palestinian who believed that he was not sympathetic to the goals of the Arabs in the Middle East. And Bobby Kennedy dies within 24 hours. This is June of 1968. By the end of the year, 15,000 young Americans died in Vietnam. We had riots in the streets of Chicago at the Democratic Convention. We had a three-way race for president that year. Richard Nixon, who had taken himself out of politics in 1962, was back in with a new strategy to make the Republican Party the dominant party of the American South, and to play what he called the silent majority, portray himself as the statesman with a plan to end the war in Vietnam. And Hubert Humphrey, the happy warrior, who had been the liberal conscience of the Democratic Party, was now stuck with the Lyndon Johnson war legacy, trying to remain loyal to his friend, but at the same time expressing his own doubts about the wisdom of our policies in Vietnam. And a third man was in the race, George Corley Wallace, the governor of Alabama, who came out of that state on a stream of hateful invective, preaching the gospel of violence and bigotry, and attracted a considerable following. And then that year, in November, Richard Nixon was elected, but just barely, and promised to bring the country together, but instead gave us Watergate and six more years of Vietnam. But we got through it. We managed to heal the wounds over a long period of time, to learn some lessons from all that we'd gone through. There were fissures everywhere. A lot of people look back in the 60s and think, really, it was represented by a young hippie girl dancing in Golden Gate Park to the strains of James Taylor in the background while a guy's off to the side hitting on a bong, getting completely stoned. But there were young men every day going down to enlistment offices and raising their hand and volunteering to go to Vietnam, as well as answering the draft. Construction workers wearing hard hats who didn't have the advantage of a college education or the deferment that came with it were reporting for work every day. People were still going to church on Sundays, and merchants were opening their doors and trying to keep America moving in the same direction. So that was a traumatic time, and I don't think we've had anything quite like that in 2000, in the 21st century, as desperate as the attacks of 9/11 were, and we're still playing out the consequences of that. But that was a very substantial, profound challenge to the fabric of American life.
Mm-hmm. Talk about Watergate for a moment, because I know some of the many people in the audience have a fascination with that. And you were you at the White House then?
I was at the White House during Watergate.
You moved there in 72?
I got there in 73, the summer of the hearings. Watergate sneaked up on us in a way, they might have gotten away with it, although it's hard to believe it if it hadn't been for Carl and Bob, Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, two young, new kinds of reporters who really believed in shoe leather and weren't part of the Washington Press Institution going to lunch every day and hanging out with the power brokers. So when I got to the White House in the summer of that year, there was a general belief that now that the hearings were over and that Haldeman and Ehrlichman were going to go to jail, that the president probably had dodged a big bullet. And it was going to be probably okay. Here's an amusing story. One of the first things that I covered in August of 1973 was a press conference given by Spiro Agnew, who was said to be under investigation by the FBI for corruption during his days as governor of Maryland. And he went out and he gave a bravura performance, answered all the questions. Everybody came back and said, isn't it refreshing that we've got at least one public official who's willing to stand up and answer the questions? And the next day I went over to see the Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, and I said, so Vice President yesterday and covering the White House.
Are we through the worst of it, Mr. Attorney General?
Knock on wood, Mr. Brokaw, we're through the worst of it. He later told me that he had in his desk the indictment that they were about to prepare for the Vice President of the United States, who had been stealing everything except the toilet paper in any public party where he had been. And then it just began to unfold day after day after day. You know, we went through the Six-Day War in the fall of 1973. You would go with the president to various public occasions. I remember going to the Southern Governor's Conference in September, late September. He said there, the worst of it has passed. He went to Disney World and he said, the country deserves to know whether the president is a crook. I'm not a crook. He was so beleaguered and so determined to show that he was not what a lot of people thought that he was, that he decided to go out to his home in California and not take government aircraft. So he got on a United flight. Can you imagine this? The president of five Secret Service agents got on a United flight without telling anyone. And we knew that he was trying to dodge the press as much as anything. And so I flew through the night on another red-eye flight so I could be outside his San Clemente gates the next day, which I knew would not please his staff at all, reporting on where he was and what he was up to. And there was this long kind of drip, drip, drip water torture that the country was put through. It was a real constitutional crisis. I didn't know how it was going to turn out. I didn't know whether we'd survive. There was a time when I didn't know whether Richard Nixon would call out the troops to defend the White House. And then, of course, by the summer of 1974, he was withholding the tapes, and the Supreme Court ruled that he had to give them up. And within 48 hours, a smoking gun appeared, as we all suspected it had been there all along, and it was. And it was, in many ways, a surreal week. I got home one night about midnight, and Meredith had left out some cold chicken, and I was reading the transcripts of the tapes. And she leaned over me and said, "Honey, those are historic documents, and you've now got chicken grease all over the page." And I went on the air the next day, and then I went down to the White House when Richard Nixon was going to be making that tortured farewell to the staff in the White House. And I have these odd memories of Tom Gerrell, the White House correspondent, had gone on vacation just before the tapes came out, before the Supreme Court decision. And he'd run into some shopping center in Maryland where he lived to get a haircut because he was going to have to go on the air. And I'm here to tell you it was the worst haircut I have ever seen in my life. And we were standing in the East Room of the White House, and nobody in the press corps was saying anything about Gerrell's haircut, waiting for the president, when Ron Ziegler, whose life is now over in effect, because he's defended the president, then comes bustling into the East Room, stops, wheels around, and says, "Gerrell, that's the worst haircut I've ever seen." And I watched the president walk out, escorted by Gerald Ford, throw up his arms in that victory salute that he thought would irritate everybody, and fly off. And within 24 hours, Gerald Ford had said, "Our long national nightmare is over," and the country moved on.
Before you came, I watched some of the video on the internet about the 9/11 coverage you did. You write poignantly about that in your autobiography, A Long Way From Home, standing in your apartment, and being able to look at the skyline. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, that was the single hardest day. And it was more than a day, but that one day was extremely difficult. And for all the obvious emotional reasons, but also as a professional journalist, with all of you out there looking in, saying, "Help me, I need to know what's going on." And we didn't know. There had been no preparation for that. There was no active body of intelligence that we could turn to and say, "This is where they came from and what happened." It was unexpected.
At one point, early in the morning hours, sometime, I believe, before the towers went down, I looked into the camera and said, "This is war." And there had been no declaration of that yet. I said, "This is the most serious attack on the United States since the War of 1812. Hawaii was not yet a state when Pearl Harbor happened. This will change us." And then a few minutes later, I was watching the towers, and I grew up around construction. And I looked into the camera and I said, "I hesitate to say this, but those towers are going to have to come down at some point because there's been so much structural damage." And then I thought, "Don't do that. Don't say that. That's going too far." And 4 minutes later, they came down. I didn't anticipate that they were going to come down that day. I can't say that. And with every passing 15 minutes, there was more trauma to report, more uncertainty about what was going on. And if you do what I do, and I'm a pretty emotional guy, you kind of operate on two different planes. You try to be as professional as you can, get the information right, say it in a coherent way so people can understand what's going on, but you're always kind of taking your own temperature. Am I okay? Am I going to get through this? Do I make sense? And I kept worrying that I was going to break down because the stories, one after another, were more poignant. And I was doing fine until about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. A guy called in, he'd been in Tower 2, and he was on the phone with us. And I said, "Give me a word picture. What happened to you when the building was hit?" He said, "I rushed out to the elevator bank, they weren't working." And he said, "I saw the fire escape stairs. And I ran to that door and I turned around and I have 4 co-workers who are confined to wheelchairs. And there was nothing I could do for them." And he started to cry. And I'm always especially touched by people who are confined to wheelchairs because I'm an active outdoorsman. And they always show the kind of courage I doubt that I would have. And I thought, this is so cruel, the last moments of their life after all that they've been through, that this building was breaking up around them and they didn't have a chance. I went home late that night. As I described in the book, I looked out our library window and I could see the glow in the south of the continuing burning, and I had a big drink at about 2 o'clock in the morning and it went straight through me. It had no impact whatsoever. Adrenaline is a very strong drug, it turns out, and I thought, maybe I'll have another one. And then I thought, if I do that, I may not be in shape to get through it. So the next morning, I woke up after about 5 hours of sleep, completely electrified, ready to jump out of bed, and the phone rang, and it was my assistant, and a very dear friend of mine is a New Yorker writer by the name of Kelvin Trillin, Bud Trillin, and his wife had been in the hospital awaiting a heart transplant, and she died the night before, and it was like family. And it was cathartic for me. I cried for 45 minutes. My wife was out of Montana at the time. I just sat in my bedroom and cried. And it was, in a way, a relief valve. And then I jumped in the shower and rushed back to work, and the rest of it's kind of a blur, frankly. I mean, I don't remember details hour by hour by hour. We were just on the air constantly trying to keep track of this. About 6 weeks later, I went back and looked at my calendar to see where I had been before 9/11 happened. 9/11 happened on a Tuesday. And it turns out that on the preceding Friday, I had been in Washington as a guest of Mrs. Bush at her first National Authors Celebration, that she had all the authors that she enjoyed and others come. And I was one of the featured readers on Friday night at the Library of Congress, a black tie audience of the Diplomatic Corps and the leaders of Congress with David McCullough. It was a hugely important moment for me, personally. I felt so privileged to be there as one of the two readers, and I was reading from The Greatest Generation. And then we had a wonderful party afterwards, and the next day I came back up to New York, and on Monday it was raining desperately. And we were supposed to, I was helping honor a young climber who is blind, who had climbed Mount Everest. And we were going to have a breakfast for him at the top of the World Trade Center on Tuesday morning. But there was a problem with the schedule, so we had it in New York in Midtown on Monday night. And it was pouring rain. And I went down and introduced him, and it was a small gathering. And I'd completely forgotten about the schedule. And if we'd been at the World Trade Center in the cafeteria, none of us would have survived because no one there did. And I later said to Mrs. Bush, you know, I remember being at the White House and then at the Library of Congress reading on the Friday before 9/11. And she said, yes, and earlier in the week we had a state dinner for the President of Mexico. Now remember, they'd only been in office since January. So she said, that's what I thought the presidency was all about. State dinner, author's luncheon, and then she said, then it was 9/11. So it was a very traumatic time, obviously, for the country. I'm not sure that we took full advantage of the spirit that existed in the weeks and months after 9/11. I thought there was a rare opportunity for both parties, frankly, to come together and say that we're now joined in common enterprise here. Some sacrifices will be required of all of us, and we'll have to find a way out of this.
When you're sitting there and information is coming into your head and you're on camera speaking to 16, 20, how many people? Millions of people. What are you thinking? Because you're looking and you're saying, you know, this is war. And I'm thinking, you've been on the beach at D-Day, you've interviewed these veterans, all that stuff is informing your internal compass.
You have one thought, and that is get it right. I'm, honestly, I'm not overstating it. It's just, please, let me get it right. And I'm double questioning everybody who brings anything to me. They say something in my ear, I'm saying, are you sure? They say, we're going to have an opportunity to interview. I said, that's not relevant. Let's not go there. So there's this dialogue that goes on that you don't hear when other reports are on the air. I did say later, and Dan and Peter and I talked about it as well, and we had a common reaction to it that had not occurred to us until much later. I was at that time, I wish I still were, I was 61. And it took everything I knew as a journalist, and as a father, and as a citizen, and as a human being to get through that day. Everything I knew. I had familiarity with the Middle East, I knew the Twin Trade Center towers, I had written about America going through other traumas before, I knew what families were going through because I'd been a father, I was a father, and I could only imagine what it was like to have a mother or a father or a child working in one of those buildings. And what I tried to do was to keep it contextual, keep perspective, as well as deliver the facts.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Doug Stanton's conversation with Tom Brokaw.
Listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to my conversation with Tom Brokaw.
We've talked, and you said something about getting along, much like you did with the World War II stories, about today. But you gave a speech recently, right? I think that was your message, right? We're here in this room, and we need to get along. What did you mean by that? And who are you speaking to?
Well, I think these are. I think this is a passage for America. I think this is a time to take stock, to reevaluate where we've been, where we are, and where we want to go from here. And we ought to be thinking more boldly than I believe that we are. for all the clatter that you hear on the cable channels from left to right and back again. As I go around the country, and I've been all over America in the last 2 years, I did a documentary that took me on Highway 50 from the Eastern Shore of Maryland all the way to Sacramento. I did a big project on baby boomers that we began at the University of Michigan with the class of the earlier class of 1972. And what I found is that I went out into the fabric of this country, places like Traverse City or Emporia, Kansas, or East St. Louis, or little towns in Ohio that have been hit hard by manufacturing shutdowns, is that there was a recognition on the part of everyone that we all got in this together, and we're only going to get out of it if we work together. And in community after community and state after state, people didn't get up in the morning and put on a red state or a blue state or a Tea Party pin or a Republican pin or a Democratic pin. They got together at service clubs or in coffee shops or in city halls or car dealerships and said, what's best for the whole community? How do we move on? What is it we have to do? And when other parts of the community took a harder hit than some, people would kind of respond and help them out with temporary jobs or food banks. So there was a learning lesson here, I think, from the ground up that has not reached the top yet. And in my own, I suppose at this stage of my life as a grandfather, looking at my granddaughters and wondering what kind of a life they'll have and how people will look back on this time, I'd like to see more bold ideas. I'd like to see a much greater investment in education, especially in science education. I would really like to see an elevation of the idea of public service. And one of the ways that I want to do that, I've been thinking about this a lot and I've been trying it out. I began at the Naval Academy. I gave the Forrestal Lecture earlier this year. I think it's worth exploring the idea of having, in this country, 6 public service academies modeled kind of on the military academies, but nothing quite as full-blown as they are. And here's my plan. You have public service academies that run 2 to 3 years for a course, and you distribute them around the country geographically at land-grant colleges. Michigan State is a perfect example of that. Cornell is a land-grant college in the Northeast, Texas A&M in the Southwest. And that 3-year course has a full range of opportunities and a curriculum for young graduates of medical school. They go for postgraduate work in third world medicine. Young political scientists go and they concentrate on conflict resolution. Everyone learns an exotic language, Arabic or Pashtun or one of the languages in the hotspots in the world. You have people who have computer skills, for example, who develop new software for teaching English or other languages in remote villages in Afghanistan, where Doug has spent a lot of time, and so have I. You have other technicians who develop very portable devices, so you can go into those remote areas, and with a simple generator and a small dish, you can download the kind of information that the villagers that we see when we go out there need about simple agriculture and nutrition and simple medical needs and taking care of themselves. And you do all of this in a public-private partnership. The government underwrites some of it, but major corporations in America underwrite it as well. You have a Johnson & Johnson fellow in third world medicine. You have a Caterpillar fellow in road construction in undeveloped parts of Afghanistan or the subcontinent. You have a Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation fellow using the enormous body of work that they have been able to develop to learn how to go into the most remote parts of Africa and detect, or in India, and to detect epidemics and cut them off before they get out of hand. At the end, and I call this the Diplomatic Special Forces or the Peace Corps Plus, think about the resource that these young people would be for this country after they finish a 3-year stint or a four-year stint in that kind of public service. They would come back to America and maybe go to work for Caterpillar with the kinds of skills that Caterpillar will require in this global economy, or Johnson & Johnson, or GE in developing water systems and small power generators around the world. I think we can lift this generation and engage this country in a way that it needs to be engaged around the world, because, frankly, we're losing the fight. We're not winning the hearts and minds. In New York, that young man who parked what turned out to be, thank God, a clumsy car bomb in Times Square, he didn't come out of some poor village in the remote corners of Afghanistan or Iraq. He was a child of wealth and privilege, and he was trained in Pakistan, a country that is supposed to be our ally. So we have to think out of the box. We have to think of new ways that we're going to be dealing with turning this Islamic rage down and getting it redirected so that those people who are in the Muslim world know that they can have hope beyond putting a belt of explosives around themselves, men or women, getting in a car or walking into a mosque or walking into an American aid station and detonating it. Because so far what we've tried has not worked. And so I would like to see a big, bold idea like public service elevated to a new level. And it doesn't have to be just that part of the world. Take Haiti or Katrina. Our first responders now are the 82nd Airborne or a military unit. That's not what they're trained to do, nor is it what we should expect of them. They're under strain as it is, fighting wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and in the jungles of Colombia and the Philippines. We need a whole other force, because these events are going to be more cataclysmic all the time. There are more of us living on a smaller planet, and when something happens, the consequences are instantly much wider than they would have been, say, 50 years ago when there was a much smaller population base. So, end of my sermon, if that's what I think.
If we could bring up the house lights, thank you. And if you could line up, we have rovers here, raise your hand. We'll bring a microphone to you. I'll point and you ask.
You mentioned education, and I wondered, who was your favorite teacher and why?
Oh, that's easy. I was the beneficiary of an amazing man in South Dakota by the name of Bill Farber. Bill Farber grew up in Illinois in a family of intellectuals and graduated with a PhD from Northwestern, from Wisconsin in political science, went to Northwestern as an undergraduate at the age of 22 and came to South Dakota in the middle of the Depression. And he stayed in that job until he died about 4 years ago at the age of 97. And he was such an enormous force in the lives of so many of us that when he died, this professor of political science, all the flags in South Dakota flew at half staff for 5 days. He was a man of great insight, great passions about politics and public policy. He turned out a record number of Rhodes Scholars and governors and senators and federal judges. He had people all over Washington in the Federal Reserve or in the Defense Department in very senior positions. And he had the perfect perspective on me. I came out of high school as a real whiz kid and then went seriously off the rails for a couple of years. And I mean seriously off the rails, but I thought I was getting away with it. The end of my sophomore year, Bill called me over to his house for dinner. And we had a jolly time, and we were talking about politics and everything was going on. He was a little rotund guy. And I can remember him sitting in his Barca lounger, which is his favorite chair, clasping his hands across. He says, "Well, young Thomas, I have an idea for you." And I said, "What's that, Dr. Farber?" I was really flattered that he's been thinking about what I should be doing. He said, "My idea is that you get the hell out of here." He said, "I want you to go leave school until you get all the wine, women, and song out of your system. Because you're not doing us any good, you're not doing your family any good, and you're your enormous disappointment to your friends." And I thought that was kind of a ticket to party hardy for the rest of my lives. I did go away, and I didn't get really a course correction until the woman to whom I am now married intervened pretty sternly and said, you're not fooling anyone, and we don't understand what's going on with you. And I then began the course correction. I went back to Farber after 6 months. I left in the fall of my junior year, and I came back for the second semester of my junior year, and I said, okay, I get it. And he said, here is your class schedule, and here's your grade point expectation. And if you're a tenth of a point below it, I'm going to be all over you. And we were always fast friends, and he really saw, I think, in me some potential that I was frittering away, and it angered him. And then I was getting married that summer to the girl who had intervened, and one job had fallen through, and there was a possibility of a job in Omaha. And so I saw Bill on the campus, and he said, so what's going on? Do you have a job? And I said, I don't, but I hear there may be one in Omaha. And he said, come with me. So I walked with him over to his house, and he handed me the keys to his car, and he said, we're going to Omaha. You're driving. And we drove down to Omaha, and I got the job. And it was a huge turning point in my life. Now, he always had perspective as well. Because after I got to a certain level of success, he would always give the address to incoming freshmen at the University of South Dakota. And he would come out onto a stage like this, and it would be filled with 1,000 freshmen. And he would bounce out on his toes and say, my God, the possibilities. That was one of his famous phrases. My God, the possibilities. If Tom Brokaw can make it, any of you can make it.
All right, thank you very much.
That was Tom Brokaw talking with Doug Stanton. Tom Brokaw's latest book is The Fall of Richard Nixon, A Reporter Remembers Watergate. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economic ecology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.